Before you mention this Irishness thing, you know, that your Irish humor, is that the key to getting along with you or understanding you?
Hey, Tom, should we make him an honorary member of our Irish socialist, anarchist, conservative, revolutionary party?
To be inaugurated, it's like a good evening in the town. Truly, if he's capable of staying.
That's right, man. You have to, you got to get smashed and make a fool out of yourself in a public place.
I resign in advance.
You got to get 86th from 7 nightclubs.
7 nightclubs?
7. For him, 7. You know, he doesn't have the constitution needed. You know, they survive anywhere. It's their sense of humor.
I'm beginning to wonder if your closest friends aren't Irish.
Let me think. Yes, I would say that's true. That's about the only people I hang around with, except for the Italians.
Dead cats, dead rats, did you see what they were at, all right? Dead cat in a tough hat. Woo! Sucking on a young man's blood. Wishing he could come, yeah. Sucking on the soldier's brain. Wishing it would be the same.
So I did a bunch of interviews with Jim's friends I forget when it was, the late 70s or early 80s. And because I wanted to preserve what they knew about Jim. You know, I did it actually after the terrible Doors movie came out.
Right.
And I thought everything about that movie is false. This is not what happened. The spirit of the times, the spirit of Jim is not reflected. Jim was not a hostile person. He was not a violent person. But here this movie has him like a crazy it was just a totally wrong portrayal. I'm not saying that the actor got it wrong. I mean, he looked enough like Jim and sounded enough like Jim, but it was the screenwriting and the directing and the way the film was put together. So I decided to try to preserve who Jim Morrison was by going out and interviewing a dozen or more of his close friends, associates, lovers, mentors, but not the Doors. Then I put a book out called, what was it called?
Hour for Magic, or was it Feast of Friends?
Feast of Friends book, yeah.
Right.
And that book had slices of these interviews in it, but not the whole interview. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I came upon these interviews while I was searching, as you sometimes do, searching for something else, and you're desperate to find the thing you're looking for, and you find something else. And I found these interviews, the tapes of these interviews, and also the transcripts of these interviews. And so that was like 20 years after the fact that I had made them, and I had kind of forgotten about them. So I went back in and listened to them, or actually I read them first. And I thought, my God, this is a treasury of insights about Jim Morrison, and I only use a page or two of these 20 somewhat, you know, each interview was somewhere between 15 and 20 pages. And I thought, I've got to get these out there because this is too valuable. And these people are too valuable. Most of them had never been heard from before. Most of them had never said a word about Jim before. They were unknown.
Yeah.
But they were close to him in many ways. So that's the origin of the book.
When I was young, you know, I'm 39 No, 38. I think I got that right. Yeah, 38. And, you know, I was like 10 when the Doors movie came out, and I remember seeing pieces of it on my local cable channels and whatever, and I knew I'd heard the songs on the radio. But as I became a teenager, I first read No One Here Gets Out Alive and found the Doors movie. So my first impressions of Jim were the wild man type. And then, but then as you dig deeper and you see the stuff that you've produced, and maybe later on you see When You're Strange, when that came out, it seemed like the real Jim Morrison was actually, you know, finally able to be publicly presented. When as before, you know, there was more money in presenting him as a wild, crazy rock star, you know, and that's the way the movie and some of these books did it. But I like it better reading your stuff and seeing how the guy really was as opposed to this image.
So, you know, I think Jim was kind of wild and crazy in the first years of the Doors. And I think he did that on purpose. He did it because he knew that the Doors had to seal a place in rock and roll if they were going to be famous in rock and roll. And I think, you know, he went out of his way to be on the edge of the stage and on the edge of everything. He was also an alcoholic, even back at that time. So alcoholism plays a big role in the portrayal of who Jim Morrison was. Mm-hmm. So he actually projected a lot of this craziness and wildness, but it didn't last that long. You know, it lasted maybe the first 18 months or 2 years, as far as I know, of their life together, of the band's life together. And he started to see that he could be himself, that he didn't need any more publicity or promotion, that in fact he was blowing up an image of himself that he didn't want. He didn't want to be a sex god. He didn't want to be a crazy, wild, drunken rock and roll fool. He was too smart for that. But it was, there were roles he was playing, except for the alcoholism, and that's not a role you play. That's a role that plays you.
Right.
Anyway, so the movie's portrayal of him might have gone to a certain point, but didn't go far enough. It didn't show the Jim Morrison who took off those leather clothes, who grew his beard long, who tried to publish his own poetry, did publish his own poetry. We don't see that part in either one of those two examples you mentioned, either the Doors movie or Nothing Here But Lots of Lies. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that. It's called No One Here Gets Out Alive. We call it Nothing Here But Lots of Lies because it's a book of full of untruths and speculation and making Jim seem like a jerk. And friends of mine, friends of Jim's, who read the book, some of them couldn't read past the first, second, and third chapter. One woman I know, a very wonderful woman, who read the first 30 pages and started crying because this was not the friend that she knew. I feel that way about the Doors movie, although they asked me to be a consultant on the movie. They wanted to use my photographs. And I said, well, what's the script going to be like? And they wouldn't tell me what the script was going to be like. So I kind of had a sense that, you know, I didn't want to get caught in a situation where I was supporting a view of Jim Morrison that wasn't my view. So I refused to have anything to do with the movie. And I'm glad I did, because the movie is about the time I lived in L.A., the people I lived around, the work I did in L.A., and in the 60s. And it's, I don't see any portrayal of the spirit of the time in that movie. I don't see any portrayal of the people I knew. I see something entirely made up. In other words, a Hollywood bio film. I see that, but I don't see the time and place and people that I knew in that movie. So it's a Hollywood movie. It's a fiction movie. But a lot of people get their impression of Jim Morrison through that movie. And a lot of people have originally gotten their impression of Jim Morrison through Nothing Here But Lots of Lies.
Right.
That's unfortunate, but that was the first book written about him. And it was highly, highly successful. It still sells copies. So my attempt has been to try to push out into the public view Jim's poetry, conversations I've had with Jim, my photographs of him, other people's experiences with him, so that we have an alternative or more balanced view of who this guy was.
Right, and as a fan, like I said, I really do appreciate that because I did own An Hour for Magic. I did own The American Night when it came out, one of his poetry books, and Wilderness as well. And I know you had a hand in putting that stuff together. So, like I said, as a fan, I appreciate you helping to build that whole picture of the guy rather than just the image that, you know, is portrayed and utilized on T-shirts and to sell videos and things like that. You know, what I also appreciate is the fact that you've opened your, you know, photo archives, if you will, and you're showing a lot of pictures that even to this day hadn't been seen before, had been seen very little, because as a Doors fan, you see the same pictures a lot. And that same picture, of course, with the arms spread and everything, is the one that sells a lot of posters and a lot of whatever. But as a fan, you know, you want to see some pictures from the later years, and for some reason those aren't as widely available.
And also I'd like to say to the fans out there that are listening, the photos of Jim, sometimes called the young lion photos, the right. ones without a shirt on, and yeah. he's got a beads around his neck, yeah. he hated those photographs.
Right.
He came right. to understand that this was not himself. You know, this was some sort of makeup thing, and he got tired of it and didn't want it shown, and yet people to this day continue to use that photograph as a symbol of Jim Morrison. Well, he hated it.
Yeah, posing for a picture, can you imagine? You know, and really looking in the camera and really posing? It's insane. I must have been out of my mind.
Best not to buy those posters, fans. Best to buy something else that is more, buy a book of his poetry. This, if he was alive, that's what he'd want you to do.
Well, to take a step back momentarily, kind of go back to the beginning, you met Jim and Ray Manzarek from the Doors out at UCLA, is that right?
That's right. We were all at UCLA, at the film school at UCLA at the same time. In fact, Jim and I were entered UCLA at the same time. That is, we both started. We didn't start our freshman year at UCLA. He came from another university, and I came from another university, and but there we were at the film school the first day in the same classes together, because we were starting in the same semester there at UCLA.
Did you guys have the same taste in movies at the time?
The people at UCLA, the young filmmakers who were gathered there to learn filmmaking, would-be filmmakers, they were an eclectic group of people, and we had far-ranging ideas of what movies should be. Some people like documentaries, although there were not a whole lot of those people. Some people like the films of the, you know, John Ford and the West American Westerns.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people like the Japanese films of Kurosawa. Some people like the New Wave French films. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people like several of those combinations together. It was widespread. I think my feeling was I was enjoying at that time the French and Italian New Wave movies, the English New Wave movies, and the Japanese movies. And I think Jim was more into American classic movies, that is, the gangster movies of the right. 30s and 40s, and the cowboy movies, the Western movies of the 40s and 50s. We were somewhat different in our approaches to what films could be about, or the kind of films that we wanted to be involved in.
His student film, you know, you've seen there's different descriptions of it, and it's portrayed on screen in the Doors movie, as we mentioned. I don't know how much of that I would trust, but did you see his student film, and what were your thoughts on it at the time?
I did see it.
Yeah.
I didn't see it the way he would have liked to have people see it. But I saw it at the student screenings, which we would have after every semester. The students would get together and with the faculty, and we'd show the films we made for each of our project classes. And unfortunately, Jim's film kept breaking in the projector because of his poor editing technique. And so you never got the sense of the whole film. I never got the sense of the whole film as one piece. But there were wonderful, strange images, as you could imagine, from a mind like Jim Morrison's, in the film. And the film has disappeared. It's never been seen again. That was, I believe, its one and only showing.
Wow.
The only film I made there was a film that was questioning the film process itself. So it was kind of a film about
film. Mm-hmm. I don't know. A few people liked it, and most people were indifferent to it.
Now, at the time, it seemed like, you know, from what I've read and everything, that his path, he wanted to be towards film and movies and directing and everything like that. When you guys were in film school together, did you get any sense that this guy might have an interest in music and he might wind up taking that path?
I no indication of that at all.
Wow.
None. Absolutely not. Ray was active during the days we were in film school. He and I were very close friends during that time, Ray Manzarek and I. And so I went out and you know, would see Ray play with his brothers and or by himself, you know, at different clubs around Los Angeles and the South Bay area of Los Angeles. But I, you know, Jim never evidenced any interest in music as far as I knew, although he probably was interested in the new music that was coming out. The Stones and the Beatles were fresh and new in those days. And, you know, the Who and the Kinks and even American bands were coming to the fore, the San Francisco bands. And I'm sure he had an interest in all of that music because the music of that time was really somewhat of our anthem. Through the music, the expressions of who that generation was being presented. That is our quest for freedom, our quest for justice, dislike of the war that was going on in Vietnam, our need for trying to have equal opportunity for everyone, no matter your race, your gender, or your creed. All of that was being expressed in the music. And also the spontaneous youthfulness was being expressed. I mean, the Beach Boys were talking about just having a great time on the beach or in cars, and Country Joe and the Fish was talking about Vietnam. But somehow we listened to all of that and loved all of it, and it was part of our life. It was the, you know, we didn't carry around a Walkman because there were no Walkmans. We didn't carry around an iPod. We didn't have streaming anything.
Yeah.
But somehow we managed to listen to as much music as we could listen to.
So I take it you were extremely surprised when, you know, school's over and, you know, you hear that, you know, I guess Jim's plans were to go to New York and try to continue to pursue film. And then next thing you know, your friend's back and he's, you know, working out some songs with Ray. What was your first experience, you know, whether it was catching those guys at a rehearsal or how did you find out that they were working together musically?
I think Ray told me, yeah. You know, my wife and I and Ray and at that time his girlfriend, later his wife, Dorothy, hung out a lot together. And Ray happened to mention that, you know, the story he tells about meeting Jim on the beach and
right.
Jim is writing some lyrics and the next thing I know, they got some other band members and they're rehearsing at a house on the beach. And I went to listen to that. And then they had some demos cut and I went to listen to those. And I wasn't overwhelmed or very much impressed. I thought the lyrics for the songs I heard were really kind of different and kind of great. Mm-hmm. I didn't think Jim's singing style was going to, you know, rival anybody else's. Definitely he was not a Paul McCartney or a John Lennon or a Mick Jagger. I just didn't see the potential. But he was just starting out. He had never really sung before. So he was developing his pipes. And I saw them the first time they appeared on the Sunset Strip in the first club they appeared on. I saw them subsequently several times. I was dubious and doubtful of the potential. But I'm good at spotting entertainment acts. I've made probably several bad judgments, but I didn't think Jim Morrison was going to be a famous rock and roll singer. If I could be honest about it, the first time I saw him on a stage actually was the first time they appeared on the Sunset Strip, and he had his back to the audience most of the time, and the audience was made up of all our film school friends. That's who Ray and Jim tried to get to come to fill the club up, and we're all there. Well, a lot of us were there, and yet he was so shy. He kept his back towards all of us and tried to sing that way. And the band was good. Yeah. Ray was a great musician, was a fabulous keyboard player, and knew ins and outs of music that you know, an experienced musician would know, and tried to keep the whole thing together. So it was kind of a surprise that Ray had chosen Jim to be in a band with him, in my estimation. That was a surprise. I saw Ray play with his brothers, Rick and the Ravens,
right,
a couple of times, and I thought they were really good. I, you know, I didn't feel that they were going to jump out into the realm of Beach Boy popularity, but I thought they were darn good for a beach band, which was what they were kind of like, a beach band, you know, a local band that comes from a beach town in California. So, you know, I wasn't high on Jim Morrison becoming a rock star.
I'm not denying that I've had a good time these last 3 or 4 years and met a lot of interesting people and seen a lot of things in a short space of time that I probably wouldn't have run into in 20 years of living. So I can't say that I regret it. But if I had it to do over again, I think I would have gone more for the quiet, undemonstrative little artist plodding away in his own garden trip.
That's nice. What do you think of yourself as a human being in relation to first yourself and then to other people?
I think of myself as an intelligent, sensitive human being with the soul of a clown, which always forces me to blow it at the most important moments.
This episode of Creative Control Daily is sponsored by Blue Chew. Guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. Listen up. BlueChew.com. That's blue like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. If you could benefit from more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is the fast and easy way to enhance your performance. Blue Chew is prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor's office or wait in line at the pharmacy. And it ships right to your door in a discreet package. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. So there's no awkwardness, and you don't even have to leave the house. And as always, we've got a special deal for the Creative Control Daily listeners. Blue Chew's been with us for a while. I've gotten nothing but rave reviews from listeners, from friends who have tried it. Once you sign up for the first month, you're going to be a subscriber for life. I know I am. So if you'd like to take advantage of the special deal we offer, you visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use the special promo code CREATIVE. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com. Promo code CREATIVE to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper choice, and we thank them as always for sponsoring and supporting Creative Control Daily and the Creative Control Network. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast and the network possible. So please be sure to use our promo code CREATIVE at BlueChew.com.
A hero is someone who rebels or seems to rebel against the facts of existence and seems to conquer them. But obviously that can only work at moments. It can't be a lasting thing. But that's not saying that people shouldn't keep trying to rebel against the facts of existence. Who knows?
Me and my mother and father and a grandmother and a grandfather were driving through the desert at dawn, and a truckload of Indian workers had either hit another car or just I don't know what happened, but there were Indians scattered all over the highway, bleeding to death. So the car pulls up and stops. That was the first time I tasted fear. I must have been about four. Like a child, it's like a flower. His head is just floating in the breeze, man. The reaction I get now, thinking about it, looking back, is that the souls or the ghosts of those dead Indians, maybe one or two of them, were just running around, freaking out, and just leaped into my soul. And they're still there.
Afterwards, Jim stays in London with Pam, hanging out with poet Michael McClure. The three of them go off on a drinking binge. When Jim resurfaces, he discovers the Doors have licensed Light My Fire for use in a car commercial. Robbie, Ray, and John explain they'd tried to find it for days. They thought the commercial was unique and felt Jim would agree. But Jim does not agree. The car commercial and $75,000 evaporate.
Early on, you know, they were signed to one record deal and it didn't really work out. And they cut some demos. But next thing you know, Jack Holtzman from Elektra spots them, or one of his guys spots them, and they're in the studio recording again. Did you have any experience hanging out at the studio with those guys and hearing what they were coming up with? Or what were your first impressions of some of that first album and maybe the demos or whatever you had heard?
Well, let's see. It would have been the summer of 66.
Yeah.
The summer of 66, my wife and I joined the Peace Corps. And we're sent to Africa. Mm-hmm. So we're about as far away as you could get from the Los Angeles music and entertainment scene. Joined the Peace Corps because the alternative was being issued a uniform and a rifle and sent to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to do that. It wasn't an unpatriotic thought on my part. It was just that I didn't feel this was a just war, and that if I had an alternative, I would take the alternative. The alternatives were going to jail, going to Canada, joining the Peace Corps, and that was all there really was. So my wife and I joined the Peace Corps and spent a year in the Peace Corps, far away from the LA music scene. By the time we got out of the Peace Corps, the Doors' second album had come out.
Wow. Yeah.
Strange Days. And I had heard the cuts from the first album because when it came out, we were already in Africa or in training for Africa. And so I hadn't really heard the first two albums till we got back to the States in the end of 67. I was blown away by both albums, but especially the second album.
That's great.
And, in reverse, it made me humble because here was an obvious talent that I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
Although I knew them personally and was around them at the beginning. I was very, very, very impressed and really knocked out by what they had done to that point.
That is kind of funny that, you return to the States and California or whatever, and it's like, bam, they're on billboards. They've already had a number one song, like what a change, what a different place to come back to. Your friends are in this huge band now. When you left, they were just kind of, drumming along and trying to find their way.
Right. And, the funny thing was that Ray sent us a copy of the Time magazine in which the band was given a whole column, I believe, about their first album and about Light My Fire. And Kathy and I read that article and read it twice and three times and thought, is this a fake? Is this really happening? But thanks to Ray being kind enough to you know, get the magazine in an envelope and get it to the post office and figure out how to send it to us. We had some foreknowledge of what was going on. You know, where we were was a village in Africa. We couldn't even get a radio station.
Yeah.
You know, probably if you had a multi-band radio, you could pick up stuff. But we were just living a village life, really, you know, helping people in Africa sustain their crops and get water and, you know, do those kind of things. Mm. So we got this article, and when we went back, we from Africa, we stopped in Paris on the way back, just sort of like a change of planes. And we walked up and down in Paris along the Boulevard Saint-Michel, and we saw in the record window that there was the Doors' first and second album in the record store. Back in those days, they actually had record stores. In the record store window, we were amazed. We knew about the first album, but we didn't know about the second album. So we were looking forward to getting back and getting in touch with those yeah. guys, because you know, we hadn't seen them for over a year, and here they were, the most popular group in America.
Well, initially, I didn't start out to be a member of a band. I wanted to make films and write plays, books. And so when I found myself in a band, I wanted to bring some of those ideas into it. We never really did too much with it, though.
So what was the first big major concert that you saw them perform at? Was it in California?
So the first big concert we saw them perform in was a few weeks after we returned.
Yeah.
Rick invited us to go to a concert. I forgot the name of the auditorium in Los Angeles. This was in December of 67. And we went to this concert. Again, I'm sorry, but I've forgotten the name of the place we went in. And again, you know, we felt, oh my God, what's going on here? This is nothing like the band we knew before we left. I mean, you know, Jim didn't even turn around to the audience on that concert that we saw him in a year or so before. So we were mightily impressed by the band during that concert. And you know, renewed our friendship, regained our friendship with Ray and Dorothy and Jim, and met the other members of the band, which we had just met briefly before that. And, you know, I settled into doing film work. I mean, that was my major. That was my degree. So I, as soon after we got back, I got a job with a film company and started making documentary films.
It's kind of jumping around a little bit, and this is a couple of years later, obviously. But is it Highway or HWY? How would you?
Well, we used to say Highway.
Okay, so with
HWY, really the abbreviation
yeah.
for Highway. It was always known as Highway.
So how did that project come about? And had you done any work with Jim film-wise, or was that the first project?
No, I worked on the film called Feast of Friends, the documentary that the Doors made,
and that was filmed
about themselves. Yeah.
That was filmed prior to that, right? Okay.
That was the film prior to that, yeah. And they produced that film. They put up the funds, and they produced it. And Paul Farrar and I and Babe Hill were the crew. Paul shot probably 85 or 90% of the film. I shot about 10% of the film. And I edited the film. It was what I was doing in the film industry at the time. I was a professional film editor, and so I was able to, you know, put all these random shots and random scenes together that Paul was filming all over the country at concerts and try to make a film out of that. And Jim helped with that process in many, many ways, but would often come to the editing room and spend time with me looking at what I was doing and how I was. He was interested in making films, so he would watch me and make suggestions, or we would talk about the scene I was trying to cut. And so that was the I think of that as the beginning of our personal friendship.
Yeah.
Those evenings we spent, because I like to work at night, especially film editing, because there's less activity to distract me. And so he would come maybe from rehearsal or maybe from the studio or maybe wherever he was out and come and sit for an hour or 20 minutes or and we'd look at some of the scenes that I was cutting. And we talked about books. We talked about movies. We talked about our days at UCLA. We talked a little about what he had gone through that year I was in Africa. And, yeah, we got to know each other.
A friend and I went to Atlanta for a film festival. We had a film entered there, and then we drove from Atlanta to New Orleans.
You had a film enter there?
Yeah.
What kind of film?
Well, it was a little 40-minute documentary on a rock and roll band traveling around the States. We shot about a year ago.
What, you mean on the Doors?
Yeah, it's called Feast of Friends. They showed it in the New York Film Festival, too. And so actually, it was just an excuse to go to Atlanta, and then we drove to New Orleans from there. I dig the South.
You know, one of the really cool things about that When You're Strange documentary that came out a few years back was that they took the footage from Highway and they really, like, they made it look like it had just been made. It was really crisp and clear, as opposed to, as a fan, and for myself anyway, I'm sure there were bootlegs around, but I always would have trouble locating any footage from the movie. I mean, you would see some of it. I know they put some in a Doors music video for Ghost Song that came out of one of the VHS tapes, but you didn't see much of it, and you only read about it or heard about it or knew the story. And then I just thought that was really a cool part of that documentary, that you could finally see, you know, a lot of the stuff that was filmed, whether it's Jim driving or Jim walking along the road, and he comes up on the believes like a dying dog or coyote, and just different things that you hadn't experienced before. It made the film look really, really, you know, really crisp, really clear, and really new.
Well, the film was shot on 35mm professional film.
Yeah, yeah.
The negative has been maintained, and when the film is finally released, the entire 50-some-odd minutes of film will look like those few scenes that were in that documentary. Wow. Because it's a professional grade. It's what Hollywood movies were shot on, the same film stock that we used making Highway. 35mm, not 16mm, not something kind of like queasy looking. This was this was the real solid thing. Jim wanted a movie that he could show to people, primarily because he wanted to write and direct movies, and he wanted his crew, that is the other three of us, to be his crew on these movies. And when he moved to Paris, he took a print of Highway with him to show in France to his filmmaking friends. French filmmaking friends.
Right.
And so his ambition was to be able to have enough control to be able to write and direct his own films with the help of other people, because filmmaking is normally a group activity. You know, it's a team sport. But he was vitally interested in doing a great film. And I think Highway, although it's very abstract and some people find it hard to follow what's going on. It was made in the feeling of an experimental film, mm-hmm. Or a alternate kind of film, not a beginning, middle, and end kind of Hollywood movie. Right. It was made with a different viewpoint, a poet's viewpoint, let's say. And that's why it's very interesting and why I hope it will be released soon. I've been working on it for years, and we get closer and closer to the time, hopefully, when Highway will be packaged and released, and people can see the entire film in that kind of crisp and wonderful clarity that you saw those little pieces.
Yeah, and I think if there's one thing I've experienced and noticed with Doors fans, whether it's, you know, the message boards or the Facebook groups, or just knowing personally some really big fans, you know, it's that we'll consume. We want to consume all this stuff. We want to see Highway. And then I think they finally realized that, you know, 10 or so years ago, the Doors band and the organization or whatever, that now they put out, there's so many live CDs available, where for years there wasn't. And you always had, oh, it's a bootleg of the Doors in Pittsburgh or a bootleg of the Doors in Boston. They finally got wise to it and started releasing their own, copies of it through their own label, you know, and it just it seemed like it took a while, but now there's a lot of content out there for Doors fans to consume.
I just wanted to comment on this for a second, and I want fans to be aware of this. There is unreleased Jim Morrison poetry, that is spoken poetry.
Yeah.
There is unreleased Jim Morrison writings. There is Highway that's not been released. There are several other areas of Jim Morrison undertakings or projects that have not been released. But a lot of Door stuff has come out. So I think fans should get up and start shouting at Door's management or somebody and say, hey, we've got a lot of Door stuff out here. Let's see Jim separate from the Doors now. Let's see him as a poet. Let's see him as a writer. Let's see him as a filmmaker. Let's get some of those things released. Without the input of the fans and friends of Jim Morrison, those things are going to sit on shelves and not be released if we're not careful. But I want to say that the stuff that's not been released is equal to, if not better than, the stuff that's already been released.
Mm. In watching you perform on stage, I got a funny, similar kind of feeling as I'm having now during this interview. You know, it's sort of a disdain for the audience, and I'm feeling it directed at me now also. What do you feel now? Like the questions aren't worthy enough or what?
Hey, listen, man. This has been one of the most... this has been probably one of the most exciting interviews I've ever participated in. You're getting the benefit of my grand Irish wit all over the place. And you call it disdain. Well, you want to arm wrestle? Huh? What do you want, man? Go ahead, ask me something else. But I won't be disdainful. Sorry if I was disdainful.
Coming aboard as a sponsor with Creative Control Daily this week, I am happy to join forces with the Collar and Elbow brand. Collar and Elbow, where wrestling passion meets street fashion. Now, I'm sure my listeners have heard of the Collar and Elbow brand, brought to you by the great Al Snow, where the idea is to make cool shirts for wrestling fans. You know, cool shirts to wear out, cool shirts to wear to the gym, cool shirts for wrestling fans to not be ashamed to wear in public. You know, initially I got a Collar and Elbow shirt and hat due to the fact that Collar and Elbow became associated with keeping it 100 with Conan. So I got them free, on the cuff, on the arm, if you will. What I found from there is the shirts were excellent. Excellent material, the fit was great, and the fitted hat was pretty sweet as well. So, go check out collarandelbowbrand.com, and I'm sure you'll agree. There's a lot of cool designs on there that you wouldn't be ashamed to wear out of the house. And the material is extremely comfortable just for lounging around in, maybe working out, whatever you want to do. And lucky for you, the Creative Control Daily listeners, I've got a deal for you. That's right, to get you 10% off your purchase. It'll get you a discount off some awesome Collar and Elbow gear as well as help the show out. 10% off with the code CCDAILY, CCDAILY. That's right, 10% off at collarandelbowbrand.com with the code CCDAILY. Don't be afraid to represent. Support the show. Support Al Snow and his great company, Collar and Elbow. You won't regret buying their stuff. Honest to God, they're the most comfortable shirts I own.
In regard to what is happening with the deaths of Al Wilson and Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, where do you feel music is going, and why are they burning themselves out like this?
Well, I guess that great creative burst of energy that happened 3 or 4 years ago was hard to sustain. For sensitive people, I guess they might be dissatisfied with anything except, you know, the heights. And when reality stops fulfilling their inner vision, I guess they get depressed. But that's not a... That's not my theory on why people die. You know,
what is your
they
theory?
All have. Sometimes it could be an accident.
Mm-hmm. And
sometimes it could be suicide. Sometimes it could be murder. There are a lot of ways people die. I don't really know.
But it would be the immense drive that would perhaps burn these people. What a morbid question.
I hope at about age 120, with a sense of humor and in a nice, comfortable bed with... No, I wouldn't want anybody around. I just want to quietly drift off.
Let's see your
But I'm... Which one? But I'm still holding out for...
About 100, about 90.
I think science has a chance in our lifetime to conquer death. I think it's very possible. And,
Well, if it did, what would happen to the spirit world?
Well, they just have to fend for themselves. Leave us poor immortals alone.
I once wrote a piece on you called The Shaman as Superstar, in which I suggested that rock musicians, rock heroes, perform a religious function for kids, for young people. Do you sometimes see your concerts as a sort of ritual?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a funny thing. I've read a little bit about shamanism. I haven't seen too much of it firsthand, except, you know, what we see with the music and that kind of thing. But in tribes, the shaman could be any age, could be an old man or a young man, but the whole tribe, all ages, kind of tried to push him into his trip and listen to him. Irregardless, it was just a question of a certain psychological tendency in an individual.
Do you think the role of a rock shaman is in a time of, say, social turmoil with kids taking things into their own hands, more or less?
I don't think the shaman, from what I've read, is really too interested in defining his role in society. He's just more interested in pursuing his own fantasies.
It was the greatest night of my life. Although I still had not found a wife, I had my friends right there beside me. We were close together. We tripped the wall. We scaled the graveyard. Ancient shapes were all around us. The wet dew felt fresh beside the fog. Two made love in an ancient spot. One chased a rabbit into the dark. A girl got drunk and bawled the dead. And I gave empty sermons to my head. Cemetery, cool and quiet, hate to leave your sacred lay, dread the milky coming of the day.
You were a big part of, and from a fan's perspective, and from what I'm aware of, he had pretty much two major poetry recording sessions, one of which was put together for him on his birthday. And as this is the Jim Morrison, you know, birthday tribute celebration show, if you will, I thought that would be a really interesting thing to talk about. So if you could, tell me a little bit about how that came to be. And that would be his 27th birthday, you know, and he recorded a lot of the material that night that we would hear, you know, in years to come, whether it's American Prayer and Ghost Song and things like that. And we've seen pictures from the session. It just seems like it was a really interesting experience. So if you could take me there and let me know all about it.
So first I want to go back to 18 months before Jim's 27th birthday, because he walked into a studio at Elektra and laid down a lot of poetry and laid down some stuff with him playing the piano and singing. Then on his birthday, December the 8th, 1970, his 27th birthday, he decided that as a birthday celebration, he would buy himself studio time. So he paid the money for the studio and the engineer and the tape and everything else. He booked the time at the studio so that he could record his poetry. So his idea of a birthday celebration was him being able to record his poetry in a professional way.
Right.
He invited a few friends to come, and I brought my camera along, which I didn't always do, regrettably, now that I think about it. But I brought my camera along, and I was able to take some photos of Jim recording his poetry with some of his friends, and then us going out to have tacos together in the middle of the recording session. He was as happy as could be, probably as happy as anybody could be on their birthday, because he was doing something he wanted to really do, that he thought it was important for him to do. He understood that he was going to be leaving the United States soon. And so I suspect that some of this, some of his initiative to get to the studio was to lay down some tracks of his poetry that would survive him in case anything happened to him, which, of course, we know something did happen to him. Mm. The American Prayer album is not made up of the birthday tapes. It was made up mostly of the Elektra recordings.
Ah.
80% of what's on the American Prayer album, maybe 75% or 80%, is made up from those Elektra recordings. Only a little bit of the stuff that Jim recorded on his birthday has ever been heard by anybody. It's not been released. It's not been booted. It's been secret. Virtually. Well, not secret, because people know he made two recordings, but it just hasn't been released.
Is that because American Prayer obviously was released under the Elektra label? Is that because that material was owned by Elektra, and the material that he recorded on his birthday is kind of who owns it? Where's the ownership in that?
Well, everything is owned by the estate of Jim Morrison. That is his family, right? and Pamela Corson's family.
Right.
All the copyrights are owned by them.
Mm-hmm.
Elektra Records owns the recording of American Prayer that was made with the Doors music. Jim didn't want Doors music in with his poetry. This was a situation where we all had to agree that the only way this poetry was going to get out back when we made American Prayer was if the Doors name was on the cover of the album.
Yeah.
And because no one thought that a poetry album, even by Jim Morrison, would sell any copies. Well, they were entirely wrong. I'm not knocking the music. I think the music's wonderful. But Jim didn't want music, especially not Doors music, with his poetry. I mean, he made that understood many times. He was trying to create a separate but equal existence for himself as a poet and as a writer. That's why his books, self-published, were titled whatever they were titled, and the author's name was James Douglas Morrison. It wasn't Jim Morrison. It wasn't that he was trying to hide the fact that he was a rock and roll, but that he was saying, here's this other part of me. This is James Douglas Morrison. Please don't think of me as that wild rock and roll guy that people keep writing about. I'm this other guy too. I'm a filmmaker. I'm a poet. I'm a writer. I do a lot of other things too. So to mingle the two things, the poetry, which he never recorded with the Doors, by the way, he didn't ask any of the Doors to come to his poetry sessions to record them. He didn't want their music in that. He wanted to create a separate kind of body of work. And so who owns everything? Well, everything is owned by, as I said before, by the estate of Jim Morrison, which is comprised of the families that survived him. And you know, they're as intent as I am and as Jim's fans are of releasing as much of Jim Morrison's work as possible in the future. And sometimes it's difficult. I can't specifically state why it's difficult, or maybe I shouldn't even talk about it. But I want people to know that Jim's sister Anne and her children and Corky Corson, when he was alive, have made enormous efforts to get Highway and Jim's poetry and Jim's writings released.
So after the birthday poetry recordings and stuff, the final, LA Woman came out, and those guys weren't really on the road anymore. They had stopped, and the future was uncertain, if you will, and Jim was going to Paris. Now, what had he said to you about his plans for Paris? Did he ever feel like, oh, I'm just going to take a break, I'm going to come back and get back with the guys and make some more records, or was he planning on a whole different path?
My impression was he was going to Paris to write and to show Highway to the people in France who he thought might be influential in finding him money to make a film, maybe in France, maybe in the United States. So he wasn't taking music with him. I'm not going to say definitively that he had quit the band, but I do want to say that he was tired of singing in large venues. He was tired of singing the same music. People were always asking for Light My Fire and Love Me Two Times or whatever. And he was tired of doing all of that, and he saw a path for himself as a writer, filmmaker, poet. And that's what he was going to Paris to develop. Take a break and also work on some of his own personal projects, his own creative projects. That's about all I can tell you. Yeah. I know that he wrote a postcard. It's probably available somewhere on the internet to his accountant and saying, you know, considering how much money I have now, how long can I stay? How long can Pamela and I stay in Paris? He didn't know how much money he had earned. He didn't carry around a wallet full of cash. He didn't own a car. He never owned a house. He owned a car at the end of his life, but that was something different. Anyway, he had no conception of the economy he was living in or any of that. I mean, it's not that he didn't have the concept of understanding. He was way smarter than anybody I've ever met. And so he understood the concept, but he just didn't participate in it. He lived like a hippie in a sense. I mean, he lived from day to day with whatever money he had in his pocket and would get an allowance from the Doors accountant. So he's in Paris. He wants to stay there. He doesn't know if they can stay there because he doesn't know how much money he has. He writes to his accountant to ask, considering how much money we're spending how much money I have, could you tell us how long we could stay here? Mm. I mean, he could stay there the rest of his life. But he just didn't see that. He didn't understand the wealth that the band was generating.
Now, was it like a radio silence situation while he was away or abroad, or did you hear from him periodically?
Well, we had a very nice exchange of letters.
Yeah.
I didn't talk to him on the phone. Catherine talked to him on the phone once when she was working at the Doors office, because for a while she was the Doors secretary. And he asked her to send him his poetry notebooks. So she gathered all those up. And he asked for a copy of Feast of Friends, the film Feast of Friends, because he wanted to show that also in Paris. And we had an exchange of letters in which his letter to us was inviting us to come and stay with them in Paris, because we had told them we were going to be taking a trip to Europe and maybe we'd run into them. But instead he said, come and stay with us for a while. We'd love to see you. You know, he sounded lonely in the letter. That is, he was missing his friends and he didn't speak French. So it was a little bit difficult for him, there.
So eventually,
the next time we heard from him, or about him was that he had died.
Now, of course, I hate to ask, you know, about the subject, about, you know, the death of a close friend and everything. But there, you know, of course, there was such mystery and speculation. And man, it still even goes on, which is pretty wild. But how did you first hear of it? You didn't hear it over the radio, right? Did someone give you a call?
So Bill Siddons, who was the Doors manager at that time, had taken the first plane to Paris once he heard from somebody in Paris that Jim had died. And he called us immediately within that day that he arrived to give us the news. In fact, it was the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Kathy and I were with Babe Hill. We were just getting ready to go out and have a little bit of a 4th of July celebration. And Bill called us at our house, and gave us the news.
Man,
so that's when I heard. That's how I heard.
Is it, man, does that kind of spoil your 4th of July's after that? I mean, that's a hell of a bit of news to get on. And then you kind of associate it with the holiday, you know?
Well, it was very, very difficult because we never saw this guy as mortal.
Yeah.
I mean, we were too young to be mortal. We thought we were immortal, that we'd live forever. He never, although he took chances with his life, much more than I ever would, he didn't intend to die soon. He had no paranoia about living. He didn't have any suicidal thoughts. He always claimed he would live to an old age, jokingly claimed he would live to an old age. And so it was a shock. As a matter of fact, we didn't go out. I mean, we sat around and we drank some beers together, yeah. And Babe eventually wandered off on his own. And, you know, we were grief-stricken. We were three of his closest friends. You know, we all got, thank goodness we all got the information together because it was right. Somewhat of a support group. I would have hated to have had that fall on me alone without being able to talk to somebody about it.
We talked a little bit about, you know, his image and how he was portrayed through the years and the movie and everything. But you were a close friend to Jim's and you also were a friend of Ray's. Now, did it bother you through the years later when Ray would kind of back up that mythology that maybe Jim isn't dead and maybe he faked it and maybe this and that, which was kind of used as, you know, myth making and to make him bigger than life and all that stuff. But did it bother you that they kind of used that for, you know, marketing and business?
I thought it was absurd. really, and I was offended by it,
yeah.
And because I didn't think you took a person who was obviously that smart and that good a person. He was really a very generous and good person, Jim Morrison, and make and monetize his life that so that you could make a living from it. I thought that was a mean and unconscionable thing to do. I understand it in terms of business, and it's often done in terms of business. But I'm offended by it. And although Ray was a friend of mine, I think some of that made our friendship collapse a bit because I just didn't want any part of that. I don't think Ray was necessarily behind all of that by himself. I mean, I think sure. He was. There was managers and attorneys and publicists and record companies that were also behind it. And I don't want to name any names. You named Ray's name. I wouldn't even say necessarily that he was the center of that activity, but he participated in it. We all know that. And you know, I'm sorry he did it. I'm sorry for our friendship that he did it. So I object to that.
So here we are. I mean, it's been, 48, if my math is even close to correct, 48 years since Jim passed. And, you know, people, obviously, he's still one of the biggest rock stars there ever was. The Doors are enormously successful. And but having personally known the guy and been very close with him and worked with him on films and, you know, traveled with him and hung out with him and all that stuff, how do you think he would view how things turned out, how his legacy is, if you will, and how he's thought of today and how everything turned out?
It's hard to speculate because, you know, it's like saying, I don't want to say something absurd, but it's like saying to somebody from, let's say, Argentina, how'd you like the beef steak? Well, because they serve wonderful beef in Argentina, you might have an idea that what it's like, but you don't know what it's like because you've never eaten Argentine beef. Well, Jim was saying so much smarter than I am. That I can't speculate about what he would have thought about what's going on now. If you read his poetry, you'll see that he prophesies a lot of things that are going on now.
Yeah.
And especially social media, his poetry, how he ever got to the point where he understood that there was going to be, and that people were going to be glued to screens for hours on end. I mean, we didn't even have computers in those days. I mean, we didn't have personal computers in those days. And so how he projected all of this stuff, which is, you know, available in the books that are of his writings that have been published, The Lords and New Creatures, The American Night and Wilderness, those three books, they present a picture of a man who was able to look ahead in time and see where we were headed as a culture. Other than that, I really cannot give you any kind of sense of what he would be doing now, what his life would be like now. People often ask me, well, what would Jim be like now if he was alive? How do I know? I mean, you know, this was a guy that was you know, doing things that, thank goodness I got a chance to tag along with him.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what he was doing, you know, or why he was doing it. I mean, it became obvious to me after we worked for a while what was going on. But, it's like his lyrics in some of the songs. They're surprising, those lyrics. Where did he get that notion? And what would his notions be now? I have no idea. I know that they'd be extraordinary, revolutionary, imaginative, creative, but because they're all those things, and I don't have all those gifts, I can't tell you what it would be like.
It's funny.
But I like some of the things that people told me about Jim, yeah. If I could have a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've been concerned with Jim's notoriety, let's say, and Jim's this burden he has to carry around in his death of being this totally unsympathetic character. And because of the film, The Doors, made by Oliver Stone, which offended a lot of Jim's friends, I went out and interviewed a bunch of Jim's friends and published a book of these interviews. They're more like conversations than interviews because these were friends of mine as well as friends of Jim's. These are the people who I think knew him as well as anybody knew him. And I published this book about 4 or 5 years ago called Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together. Mm-hmm. It's self-published. It's available on Amazon if you want to read a copy of it. It's available as an ebook on Barnes & Noble and a couple of other places, Apple and also Amazon. But if you really want to know who Jim Morrison was when he was alive, the last 4 or 5 years of his life, these people who knew him as well as I did, maybe better in some cases, will tell you, will confirm what I've been talking about today, and will tell you more about the real Jim Morrison, the guy who actually walked the streets of Los Angeles and was in the studios in Los Angeles and the clubs of Los Angeles, and will reveal the kind of person who we all agree was our friend. I'm not trying to sell the book. I'm trying to encourage those people who want to know more about Jim Morrison to find out
right.
who he was. And in fact, if someone wants to get permission from their local library have the book in the local library, I'll donate it to the local library because more people will be able to read it that way. Mm. I'm interested in telling the world about this friend of mine, that he was not the person portrayed in the Doors movie or those notoriously terrible books about Jim. I want to tell you that any of you out there would have seen him as a true friend.
And I really appreciate you taking the time tonight to speak to me about your friend. You know, as I said, he was a big influence to me through my teenage years on to this day. I listen to the music a lot. I read the poetry a lot. I'm always looking for, you know, new material, new stuff to listen to and read. So I will be looking forward to reading Friends Gather Here Together. But Frank, I want to thank you not only for your time, but for your role in, you know, helping get things released, whether it's, you know, the poetry books. Or like I said, I owned An Hour for Magic and your book Feast of Friends, and now Friends Gathered Together. You know, you've had quite a hand in, you know, helping shape the guy's legacy correctly. If you know, you don't mind me saying so.
I appreciate you saying that, and I want to say that it's been a joy and a wonderful experience being able to make those books and show my photographs and talk about Jim Morrison and talk with others about him. And I just hope that through this conversation and other conversations, more and more people will be attracted to him and see him for who he is.
All right, all right, all right. Hey, listen, man. I don't know how many of you people believe in astrology. Yeah, that's right, baby. I am a Sagittarius. The most philosophical of all the signs. But anyway, I don't believe in it. I think it's a bunch of bullshit myself. But I tell you this, I don't know what's gonna happen, man, but I wanna have my kicks before the whole shithouse goes up in flames. All right, all right.
Wow, I'm sick of doubt, live in the light of certain south cruel bindings. The servants have the power, dog men and their mean women, pulling poor blankets over our sailors. I'm sick of dour faces staring at me from the TV tower. I want roses in my garden bower, dig. Royal babies, rubies, must now replace aborted strangers in the mud. These mutants, blood meal for the plant that's plowed. Waiting to take us into the severed garden. You know how pale and wanton thrillful comes death in a strange hour, unannounced, unplanned for, like a scaring, over-friendly guest you've brought to bed. Death makes angels of us all and gives us wings where we had shoulders smooth as raven's claws. Money, no more fancy dress. This other kingdom seems by far the best, until its other jaw reveals incest and loose obedience to a vegetable law. I will not go. Prefer a feast of friends to the giant family.
Thoughts in time and out of season, the hitchhiker stood by the side of the road and leveled his thumb in the calm calculus of reason.
Hi, how you doing? I just got back in the town. LA. I was out on the desert for a while. Yeah? In the middle of it. Right. Hey, listen, man, I really got a problem. Well? When I was out in the desert, I don't know how to tell you, but I killed somebody.
There's a killer on the road.
No.
His brain is squirming like a toad.
It's no big deal, you know, I don't think anybody will find out.
Take
about it,
a long holiday.
Just, this guy gave me a ride and started giving me a lot of trouble, and I just couldn't take it, man. Wasting it.